the church belongs to. And we're reflecting a little bit on last night and about the mission work and culture and Christianity. We're saying that all of us who had been tapped on the forum there, when I walked in last night, we all got to reflecting afterwards, and what we really wanted to say was that that Mother Teresa and St. Francis of Assisi, probably for both of us, form models that we found much to emulate in. And the answer to the question I just asked you is the poor. According to canon law, the church belongs to the poor. I chose a portion of scripture to start us out this afternoon. And once again would invite you to close your eyes. From Isaiah 53. For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or comeliness that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that made us whole, and with his stripes we are healed. Lord Jesus Christ, in a culture of being number one and winning by intimidation, in a world that admires the strong and decries the weak, that identifies with the wealthy and powerful, and turns away from the smitten, the afflicted, the old. Lord Christ, by the power of your Spirit this afternoon, call us back and confront us with yourself. Lord Christ, grant that by your heart, our hearts might be crushed afresh, that they might be turned from stone to flesh, and that we might be newly afflicted with the afflictions for which you have lived, have died, and have risen. Convert our hearts from one of winning to one of obedience. Consecrate us again this afternoon, that somehow in our unprofitableness, we might, in the stream of your love, be found profitable in your sight. For we do ask it for the sake of your love. In Jesus' name, amen. Two Latin words that, come on in, guys. There's a pillow up here in there.
Karen will throw darts.
Okay, that's the deal. Right. Dart gallery in the rear. Right. Two words that I would pass by us, kind of in light with this, and not particularly in light with what I'm talking about this afternoon. But two words that have been stirring my pot for the last 2 years. And every now and then spoon whips around the pot again and stirs things up. Just about the time the bubbles go out of it and it quiets down. The first is the word for care. And Mary mentioned it in passing. I'm not sure she's passing the other night when she was talking about evoking gifts. But it comes from the Gothic word kara, K-E-R-A. And it means to sorrow or to lament. Our English word care means to sorrow or to lament. To care for someone is to sorrow or to lament for them. And like unto it, the Latin word patior, our word for peace, P-A-T-I-O-R, patior, and it means suffering. It's where our English word long-suffering comes from. That our patience, which is the English word that has a derivative from patior, patience is perfected in suffering. In a culture of narcissism and hedonism, those are foreign words indeed. I thought I would share with you just in beginning tonight some bad words. This comes from a non-Christian, probably the most well-known pop psychiatrist. I don't mean to demean him in that way. He's a popular psychiatrist in the United States, Theodore Rubin. In one of his last books here, The Reconciliations, and he says this about our culture. Our culture, with its values and pressures, kills time, energy, spontaneity, pleasure, sensibilities, creativity, vitality, aliveness, feelings, humanity, and life itself. Our society is a glory-seeking, pride-oriented dynamic system which influences each family to influence each newborn child to predicate his or her self-acceptance on where he or she lands in the self-glorification hierarchy. Simply put, this means that we accept ourselves almost exclusively in terms of achievement and success as it is measured by money, prestige, power, sexual attractiveness, or youth. Another cogent indictment. It's so often the people outside of our community that lay the questions or describe the dilemma, as Becker has done. We were talking about last week, Ernest Becker has done so vividly in those two books of his. This afternoon, I'd like to carry on and move into the descriptors, once again reminding us how many are here today that were not here yesterday or before. How many are new in the village? Ooh, golly. Okay. Let me just say this. I'm Lee Griffin. I'm a psychiatrist. My work for the last 10 years has been with clergy in the Lutheran Church. I'm one of those who joins you in being a peculiar one who believes in the absurdity. I don't know whether you've ever stopped to think of how absurd the story of God coming in a baby and dying on a cross is, really, that we find it very difficult. I was mentioning last week in the village that there was 600 years before the church could use the bare cross as a symbol. That for 600 years there was no cross, and then for another 300 years it was a crucis victor, where God was sitting with eyes wide open on top of the cross as conqueror of the world. That we've had a really hard time coming to this picture in Isaiah 53 of Christ as the suffering one. That he was afflicted for our transgressions, and he has borne our iniquities, and by his stripes we are healed. He didn't need the healing that we did, and we do. So when we're talking about the culture in which we live, when do we live? Talking about, I mentioned yesterday when Ortega says, life is fired at us point blank, and that as we try to go through this dialogue between I am I and my circumstances, last week we talked about, in the first Monday of this week, we talked about the I am I part of it, the nature of human nature. Yesterday we got into kind of a global background and moved through using Toffler's paradigm, a description of the waves of culture. The pre-agricultural wave, and then the thousands of years in which agriculture dominated. And then the second wave, the industrial wave, which we talked about in the Asians, that's described yesterday, the standardization and the specialization, the synchronization, the change in time concept. the concentration, the maximization, and the centralization, and went over that. But that was a global thing. And just to say, for those of you who were yesterday, remember now, don't get the idea that we've got a big tidal wave that's gone over the culture, gone over the lands, and then left in its wake nothing. What we've got, think of it more as a maelstrom, where we've got waves of culture now that are coming up. We still have pre-agricultural. We still have Indian cultures that are hunting and gathering cultures. We have much agriculture, much first wave. We have a great deal of second wave. And now for the last 20 years, this wave, this third wave, is starting in the United States. The second wave started in Europe, and the first wave kind of scattered itself on and was in China and other places. But this third wave, the wave that is boiling us up and putting in us in, if you will, social cataclysm, and is predicted to run its major course of radical social change in a few decades, probably 30, 40 years. Where the second wave took 300, first wave, in order to encompass the globe, took several thousand. So it's an amazing compression of time. And I want to talk to you just for a few minutes at the beginning today about the whole matter of stress. Can you hear me all right on the recording?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Hans Selye, who has been known as Dr. Stress in the United States and Canada and really into Europe too. He's been working for 49 to 50 years in the whole subject of stress. And though you may not identify the name, you know of his work, because you've seen some of these pop stress graphs or stress charts, especially in the family magazines and women's magazines. And he talks about it in terms of life change units, LCUs. No, there's nothing too hard. I mean, nothing that you won't understand by hearing today. So, LCUs, life change units. And here's what he got. When he got around to writing his last book, he was whipping around the country and asking people about stress. And wherever he went, he got a long face. And finally, he threw up his hands and said, "Hey, guys," he said, "you know, to be alive is to be stressed. You can't escape stress as long as you're living and breathing." Said, "What you're thinking of is distress." And so he coined another word, and he said, let's go over here now, and on this end, we'll talk about what you talk about, distress. He said, "That's the stress that shrinks you and makes you less than. That's distress." He said, "Over here now, you got another kind, and that's called eustress, E-U-stress. Now that's the stress that puts you in gear and causes you to grow, so you don't vegetate." And then when he was putting out his schematic, he put a line down the middle here, and put up here, hyperstress, too much stress, And down here he put hypostress, too little stress, vegetating, not enough stimulation to grow, just kind of sitting, going around in a teacup, So, the thing that I would like to share with you just is a bit of a backdrop for the other things that I want to say here this afternoon, is that we live in a very peculiar time. We never before in the history of humankind have had the technology to have so much data impinge on us so quickly as we do now. Someone told me just a month ago, I respected the source, but I can't remember the source. Said that in one 24-hour period of our lifetime, we have more input than our great-grandparents had in a whole lifetime, in all their lifetime. One 24-hour period. Think about it for a minute, that we have the technology now to bring us the world's events within sometimes a few minutes, but surely within a few hours. Here's what's heavy. Because negative stuff sells media, time, presence better than positive stuff, you don't hear very much about somebody helping somebody else across the street in a crowded freeway, but let something happen in the way of an attack, a murder, an accostment, a rape, something of that order, and it's on the headlines. Why? Because we like to follow ambulances and fire trucks. That's part of what makes us up. We are fascinated by darkness, by evil, if you will, by brokenness. The media picked this up, and so they give us what we want. We want negatives, we get negatives. And we're talking about a quantity of negatives that never before in the history of humankind, as far as we know, has any people been assaulted, beleaguered, overwhelmed, intoxicated, however you want to put it, with so much data in so short a period of time as are we. Now, what are we talking about? Have not other people had critical things happen to them? Of course. When Uncle Albert, 70 years ago, took the wagon and drove into Wenatchee from Chelan in order to talk to the banker about his mortgage, and that was 35 miles in. Actually, by the time he got to the bank, it was 40 miles. He spent the better part of a day going in, and the banker said, "John," he said, "I'm sorry." He said, "We renewed your loan here now for 3 years running. I know the apples have been bad, but we simply can't risk it another year. If you'll save pain and strain for all of us, you'll be ready to move off by the first of next week." Now, you think that wasn't hard news? You know, here John had worked for 37 years on that orchard. That was mighty hard news. But John had 7 hours to go back behind the horse in the dust and the fragrances with no TV and no radio, which time to enculturate, to intincturate, to insinuate, to incorporate the pain and to do something with it. He had some time to sorrow. Just thinking of a day which is not typical, but which I think may highlight your lives and not just mine, about once a year a day like this comes up. And this one was when we were living up in northern Minnesota. And it's so vivid because being up in the snow here again, I think of the morning, there were about 18 inches of fresh snow and we had a four-wheel drive. Drove the 40 miles into the airport in Duluth. It was supposed to be in Philadelphia by 11 o'clock for some crisis stuff. Got to Philadelphia at 11 o'clock. By 2:30, I was in Denver. Another crisis involvement. The evening was in San Francisco at 8 o'clock, and by the time I rolled into a motel that night, I realized that emotionally I hadn't even said goodbye to my wife, Cynthia. I hadn't even, really taken my leave of her, and I'd been involved in great pathos here across the country. I don't tell that story because it's different. I tell it because it's the same. It just happens to be a flamboyant way of telling your life stories, not just mine. That we are involved in so very much stuff so rapidly that we've got no time to assimilate a response. We've got no time to emotionally incorporate what's been happening to us. So we're a people who are intoxicated with data. Holmes at the University of Washington here in Ray, R-A-H-E, have done the pioneer work in the whole area of health and wellness as it relates to stress. And they tell us this, that too much change, either good change, too many promotions on a job, too many happy and joyful things, moving to too many bigger and bigger houses, buying too many boats, or just having too much stuff happen to us too fast, is just as toxic to us as having too many tragedies. Having too many deaths, losing our spouse, getting canned, being evicted from our house, that both are toxic, that you can get just as sick from chocolate as you can from cyanide if there's too much of it. And so what I'm suggesting to us is that whatever else defines us in this kind of cataclysmic period as the waves are crashing together and we're trying to come up with an accommodation to the end of one culture, as one social historian said, it is difficult to say whether the cries we hear are the birth pangs of a new culture or the death wails of an old. But something cataclysmic is happening. So my point, the point that I want to share with you this afternoon, is that we are a culture in hyperstress here, and because most of the data we get is negative, that most of it falls on a distressful side. That puts people in a tremendous state of beleaguerment. See, as I deal with people, I suppose that just in my area, the number of conflicts, the amount of social dishevelment, that means marital breakup, incest, rape, alcoholism. For the first time, the American Psychiatric Society came out this year and formally announced an official increase in the incidence of schizophrenia in the 30 to 40 age group. That all forms of attempt of both decompensation and attempts to avoid what is this tremendously toxic input seem to be increasing. So it's a time that I find that the people who are coming apart, and my work has been practically all with Lutheran clergy families, the people who are coming apart are not the weak ones and the losers. They're not the weak ones and the losers, they're really the sensitive ones, the human seismographs that are registering about 7 or 8 on the emotional Richter scale. They're the sensitive barometers of a radical cultural change. So without spending a lot more time, I guess we could probably spend the afternoon just on this concept alone. But I'm going to hurry on because I'll try to come to some culmination on this. Henry May, end of this, moving into a new paragraph. Henry May, social historian, has said, by the way, I'll mention books as I go along. Some of them aren't worth reading. If they're not worth reading, I won't say they're worth reading. In other words, I just won't mention it. If they are, I'll say worth reading. Okay? This one is not worth reading. It's big and it doesn't have that much in it. It's The End of American Innocence by Henry May, social historian. Unless you're a buff in that area, it's too much reading, and I'll tell you what it says anyway. What he's basically saying in there is that there are three things that describe our times, what it is to be alive now. In America, before we were talking about a world, a global thing, when we were talking about the business of the third wave, now we're talking about American scene. So there are three things which are peculiar and different to us in our times. The first one is a loss of innocence. Said we Americans up through World War II, in fact up through about 1955, considered ourselves basically the people with the white hats. That we were people who, when you scraped the barnacles off us, were really those who espoused righteousness, those who were fighters for freedom, those who believed in a fair chance for all. Those who, when you get down to it, are soft-hearted, kind-hearted, and altruistic. Huh? He said, our history with Watergate and Vietnam's and all the other demythologizing and debunking of American leadership and the American way of life has left us with what has always been true, but it has hit us like a ton of bricks, he said. The fact that we don't really wear the white hats, at best we wear the gray ones, and not infrequently the black ones. So that's been a very hard pill for us to swallow as a culture. Secondly, a loss of optimism. Perhaps no culture in the history of the world has been quite as optimistic as has been the United States. The people who have come to our shores have really had a higher degree of optimism than the people who have inhabited any recent land in any recorded pilgrimage. The name of the game here is can do. And we're noted the world over as problem solvers. That if you got a problem, bring it to the Americans. They'll have a creative answer to it. When things got tough out east, they said, go west, young woman, young man, you know, start over. Find your chance there. Find new opportunities. Well, those of us who live on the coast, the west coast, know that there's unemployment out here, that things are not so easy, that we have not found Mecca here either. He said, that's been very hard for us. A friend of mine was part of a photographic mission that went to the river mouths of the 55 streams that flowed into the Arctic Ocean, and they photographed the river mouths. He said, everyone was a garbage dump. I suppose partly with Alaskan oil and such, that a lot of people have been flying in fishing and hunting. And they left their litter with their pop and beer cans and plastic bags and such. And he said, everyone looked like a garbage dump. All these pristine primordial streams. He said, all of this has contributed to something that is unprecedented in the United States, and that's a nostalgic looking back rather than ahead. He said, we've always been a future-oriented culture, always a future-oriented nation. And for the first time, now we're looking back to the summer of 42 or, you know, whatever. That our attempt to look back and find in the old and the nostalgic. I remember I was doing a retreat here last spring in Michigan. On Saturday night, we were down at a pizza parlor. We broke for a while, and we don't have a neat spot like this all over the country, so we were down in the pizza parlor. And there must have been, it was a very large pizza bar, and there must have been probably 85 to 120 young people, ages, we'll say 19 to 25. They all had the Texas hats. Many of them had the sheepskin jackets on. They all had the wide belts with the big buckles and the high cowboy boots. And the kicker was that they were all singing songs from the 1900s to the 1920s by heart. This was a happenstance gathering of young people in the outskirts of Detroit. All of them, now I used to get two bits a throw. I played the piano some when I was young. My dad used to give me two bits every time I'd learn one of the old songs that he liked to sing. But I was the only kid in the class that knew them. There's probably nobody else had a dad who gave him two bits. But nobody else knew those songs, and here were a whole cadre of young people sitting singing those old songs by heart. Think of this particular time, that's what May is relating to. There's been a loss of optimism in the country, in addition to a loss of innocence. Could you guess, kind of quickly, where young people under 10 and over 10 and over 75 even, where the young in heart find their hope these days? Who said that?
Sweet.
Right.
I mean, I've got a 12-year-old.
Sure. See, that's it. For most of us, now see, I can get.
He literally said, "I don't want to watch Little House on the Prairie."
All right.
I don't want the old stuff.
Yeah, you already said it. That's where the younger generation is finding their hope. They're finding it extraterrestrially. Now, I can get excited about space stories, and I've always read a little science fiction, and I can get turned on about that. But I'll tell you for sure that I can look at this surroundings here now, and that really somehow is a part of me. That touches the harmonics of my heart. When I think of living on another planet or on a space platform, somehow I can envision the possibility, but it really doesn't do much for me, does it, you? Okay. Well, that seems to be our dilemma, that in the second we've lost a sense of optimism and we are a nostalgic, back-turning-oriented people. Thirdly, a loss of identity. May says that that which used to be an elitist phenomenon, I can remember back in the 50s when it was cool, if you really had your bills paid and had money in the bank and nothing better to do, to have an identity crisis and see your shrink. That was kind of a cool thing to drop in the right settings and say, you know, I've just been working with my psychiatrist or been working with my analyst, you know, straightening out my identity. Yeah. And that was one thing when it was an elitist phenomenon reserved for the few and a status symbol. May says now it's a descriptor of the whole culture, that we're a culture who've forgotten who we are. And it's very hard to operate when you don't know who you are or the other person is. It's very difficult to know what to do, very difficult to know what the ground rules are, what the definers are. Well, he said that that's been something that has been very troubling to us, that we've realized in our loss of optimism, like the West Side Story, we can't go home again. In our struggling for identity, we find ourselves casting about. I'm going to make a transition in here and carry on in the same subject, but I'm shifting gears now from Henry May. There are some other words that I want to bring in. How many of you know the words allegorical or mythic? Have you used those words in parlance at all? They're really not worth using. But because some of the social historians and students of our culture do use them, I'll use them, but I'll tell you exactly what they mean. Allegorical time of history or of culture is a time when people basically know who they are, or think they do anyway. In the United States, we've always had lots of understandings. We're a melting pot and a pluralistic nation, as we were reminded last night. But within those parameters of a lot of differences, there also have been some samenesses. And up through World War II, the students of the culture tell us that we were pretty well assured of who we were. we kind of knew ourselves as the people with the white hats, and we just come through the big war on the side of God in victory, and that that had left us in quite a lucid place with regard to our identity. Okay. So when we when we move out of that, it's about 1955 or 58, and then we move into what they call an anomian era. That doesn't mean, it just means a normless era. It's one of those times when anything goes. I think of a little poem by Fritz Perls, I guess that I've seen in so many office walls, and perhaps you have too, where it said, "You go your way, I'll go my way. And if perchance we meet, you know, that's cool." That isn't a verbatim quote, but that's what he was saying, you know, with the implication laid out in the last line, and if we don't meet, that's okay too. In other words, I'll self-actualize and do my own thing and walk my own walk, and you do likewise, and if perchance our walks happen to cross, that's nice. Not imperative, not necessary, just nice. An anomian era of history is a history then when we're floppy, we don't know who we are, anything goes. It's an era that people have said was not very different from what the people in Germany experienced after the Treaty of Versailles, World War I, and before Hitler came to total ascendance. It was a time when the German people had been humiliated. It was a time when arts and literature grew and burgeoned, but as a people they lost their esteem and their identity. And they were flopping about. Ripe game then for a secular, charismatic leader. Secular term that has the animal magazine. I would invite you sometime if you're near a university library. I stood under Dumpy Falls and got soaked this afternoon. I feel my, I'm getting a little bit frogged up. To listen to Hitler's speeches, just check out the records. You don't have to know German. I don't remember enough German to matter. But it'll mesmerize you. That's right. It's just that the charisma, it just comes right out of the record. This man was so magnetic that he just reaches out. It's exactly what Dietrich Bonhoeffer is talking about in his Life Together when he says that the weaker personalities are drawn into the magnetism, into the orb of the stronger personalities' influence. And that's why he says that our only, as Charlie reminded us this morning, the only legitimate access we have to one another as Christians is one intercessed through Jesus Christ. I mean, the story of Agnes Sanford telling when she was sitting with a group about like this, they were all pastors, and she was 75. Agnes was an old, older lady who was a Presbyterian pastor's wife. She just died 3-4 months ago now. But she was a charming person, and she was sitting kicking her feet and looking at these pastors. She said, "I want you to know that I might be 75, but I'm still horny." And she said, "Practically all my work is with you young pastors." She said, "If I didn't consciously and intentionally interpose Jesus Christ between us," she said, "I'd be horny all the time." so this is the kind of thing that comes in an anomian era, a floppy era. Now, the history of humankind has revealed a great law, a great rule that has been invoked in human behavior, and that rule is our need for structure. That always peoples of the earth have sold out their freedoms for predictability and structure and protection. Huh? We talk much about freedom, but the fact is emotionally we need structure, or we feel very anxious. Another word that we can employ is anarchy, that in the history when things have broken down and we have slipped into anarchy in the world, we have always quickly then slipped over into tyranny. Because we have been much more comfortable, as much as we kick and holler. You know, would that we were back in Egypt. Here you let us out of here just to perish. in this dumb oasis, and it's all desert, and there's no water, and those quail might not fly tonight. And, you know, and what have you done to us, leading us? At least we had some predictability, and they fed us. We're out here in this crappy desert, and you did it, by the way. You let us out, Moses. Yeah. Exactly the same story. That's our story as a culture, as people who have peopled the earth. So the response that we move into then is what is called a mythic era, M-Y-T-H-I-C. Now, mythic doesn't mean falsehood, it means story. And by a mythic era, it's what happens when a people are attempting convulsively and needfully to retell stories that will define who they are, so they can come out of their identity crisis and their lostness. Does that make sense? Have I lost you in that? When I said that we were in a mythic era, that we were in an era when we were in identity crisis, it's the same thing. I'm just telling a parallel story now. That a mythic era is a time of culture when people are convulsively attempting to redefine who they are. Christer Stendahl, and I'll mention him for the second or third time since I've been up here, because his little treatise on the Spirit Speaks to the Churches, Christer Stendahl is the retired dean of Harvard Divinity School. And his treatise on the Spirit Speaks to the Churches is an explanation of 1 Corinthians 13, Paul's hymn of love. And he says there that the practical evidence, the pragmatic evidence for the presence of the love of God, the agape of God, is the capacity of any relationship or group to embrace difference. The practical evidence of whether the love of God is around, an organization, Holden Village, Ford Motor Company, the United States, or anyplace else, is the capacity to embrace difference. Interesting commentary, isn't it? Provocative. I've thought a lot about that. What would you expect in a mythic era of culture where we have forgotten who we are, and when we're uncomfortable and uncertain in our forgetting and our lack of structure? Would you think that our capacity to embrace difference as a culture would be increased or decreased?
Decreased.
Surely. Could we find signs of that being so? What would you expect? Let me run through some. I see that time is beleaguering us, and I probably have got 2 hours worth of stuff to cram in here in 50, 55 minutes. But for once, it isn't by happenstance that the last 15 to 20 years has seen a rapid escalation of the collection of antiques. Now, I happen to be one of those who likes antiques. All I'm saying here is not that antiques are crummy. That isn't what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that it's not happenstance that we are collecting antiques in this culture in a mythic era. Why? Because antiques have stood the test of time. And when I'm not certain about where I'm going or who I am or what the ground rules are, to be able to reach over and touch something old that's been around for 300 years is reassuring. It's a time when you write books like what? Roots, right? Passages, right? It's a time when you have a Jonestown, the growth of cults. Huh? Always when a people is lost, they're highly vulnerable to charismatic leaders. And unless I say differently, I'm talking about the secular interpretation of the word charismatic. Those who exude an animal magnetism, huh? Always there's a vulnerability to that. What are some of the other things? What about politically? What would you expect? Here we are. We come out of the 50s in a conservatism of an allegorical era. We move into the Anomian 60s and early 70s. Well, when anything goes, very much emphasis on individual rights. Some of us might have considered the culture libertine, but certainly it was highly flexible and very much up for emphasis on individual rights. But what would you expect in a mythic era? Movement to the right, conservatism, right. Now, some people think we're moving back to the 50s, but that's not so. The 50s conservatism was based on an identity in which people believed conservatively, and thus they acted conservatively. Huh? The 80s is based on an attempt to define themselves, so it's a convulsive attempt at conservatism. It doesn't have the flexibility, the space for grace, the space to embrace difference. So what do we find happening in the United States? Well, just a few things. We find a rapid growth in the Ku Klux Klan. We find a rapid growth in the neo-Nazi movement. I could do some chapter and verse stories of this, but if I'm going to get a little ways along, I just won't get as far as I was planning to, but I do want to get a little bit further than this. We find that now the address to the American Bar Association in 81 was a landmark. I don't know whether you heard that, but the Chief Justice's address to the American Bar, and he was saying, basically, we've let the criminals rule for too long. Let's start upholding the law, you know, of the non-criminal. Let's start upholding the rights of the non-criminal. A landmark. Now, we're seeing this. I just noticed two newspapers down here. I don't know if you happened to, they were a couple days old, but they were Seattle papers here. The one was announcing that a judge had thrown the book at a child molester. He invoked a 1909 law and had the man sterilized and put in prison. The other one was where two young people had attacked a person who was in a filling station and shot him through between the eyes. He was in a coma. Wife was pregnant. It was really trial by the news media, because they had given a very heartrending story of this man just filling in for a friend. He was already enlisted in the service, working enough to support his wife, who was getting ready to deliver in 2 months. The fact that he'd never see his child. What I'm saying, if you're listening to it in Salem, Oregon, who's from Salem here? Somebody said they was from Salem. Salem, Oregon, and Grants Pass, Oregon, have been interesting. I've been working in that area quite a bit. Salem, Oregon, had a notice in the newspapers here within the past 8 months where the Jewish community came out in public press and told the neo-Nazis, the next person who comes to our door and asks for our children to come out, because what they've been doing is beating up the kids of Jewish people in Mesa, said the next one who comes will be shot summarily, and we'll talk about it later. They made a public newspaper announcement of that. The survivalists in Grants Pass have made very public pronouncement that when the social dishevelment or nuclear disaster or whatever comes, every person's got 8 guns, at least 10,000 rounds of ammunition, and food for 4 years. Grants Pass is so situated, those of you who know it, that it can be blocked off. And they're going to block the road off, and anybody who tries to get in will be shot. Now, this is the kind of stuff that we can expect. I'm being confrontive and tough on this, but I want to demonstrate what happens when a people gets beleaguered by fear and uncertainty. When a people gets beleaguered by fear and uncertainty, a mythic era of culture where we are trying very hard to redefine ourselves and come up with some predictability in the midst of a great deal, not only of just cultural change, but literally of cultural cataclysm. So when we talk about the business of who we are, that gets pretty difficult. Just a few more examples. The women's movement. Good example of a mythic movement. In a mythic movement, remember, one of the things, the primary definer of a mythic time of culture is when people have forgotten who they are. Well, why don't we have a women's movement, some other time? Now, basically, it looks, and I shared with a number of you my impressions on this, and it looks very much to me as if much of the time, in spite of the beleaguerment, and I'm not going to go into all the stuff, I'm doing you violence, those who didn't hear a more in-depth discussion of this the other day, and I'm sorry about that. I'll go through those the first of next week. That most of the time, in spite of their foot on, having male foot on neck position, I fantasize the women in general. Remember, we're making leaping, broad generalizations, and people who generalize are wrong, as I shared yesterday, and I'm wrong too. But I think there's enough rightness to say it. That during an allegorical time of history, during a time when we're relatively intact, When the men come out and say, now you ladies, the example I used was being up here and we're going out and have a day of sports outside. And the men have the football all lined up. And so they haul the ping pong tables out for the ladies to play. And I say, now you ladies, you just go over here and have a nice time with your tea and crumpets and ping pong. And we're going to go down and play football. Of course, you know, football is really the only game. But you just have a good time. You know that you ladies certainly aren't equipped to play football, and you remember that your mothers told you not to get bumped, because that could lead to bad things. Their breath very gently, you know, say, talk on, little man. You know, we know better. Huh? They let it pass. When you get to a mythic era of culture, when everybody's identity is up for grabs, and the women are being told as much as well as the men, hey, you're not who you ought to be, and you ought to shape up and act different, and things ought to change. Now, please don't misunderstand me. There are marvelous things that have happened in the women's movement. I'm just describing that the women's movement is a time when there is an upsurge of uncertainty, and thus a redefinition and a rekindling and reconfrontation of the issue of women's rights, of human rights, of how things ought to be handled. And so now the same outing day comes along, and the men say the same things, and the women say, really? You mean football is the only first-class game? Well, I've been kind of worried about that. I guess, you know, Mom told me not to get bumped after I went through puberty, but I can't stand to be a second-class citizen any longer. If it takes playing football, I guess I'll have to come over and risk getting bumped. And so they come over in the football diamond, and you know the rest of the story. You know, they win half the games at least, and everybody is you know, up for grabs. And I talked about that under the heading of Who Are We?
Some of us played football as freshmen at Pacific Lutheran in 1951-52.
Right.
Right.
You were ahead of your time, that's right. That's exactly right. And you know that any cultural move, we said yesterday, the Industrial Revolution didn't start with somebody throwing open the window and saying, for goodness sakes, you know, here it is, the 5th of May and the Industrial Revolution started. That is the way it goes. So always we've got waves that are pre-waves and little waves that come before the major waves and little waves that follow after waves and all of those sorts of things. But without going into a lot more stuff, then we're moving into a culture where we can predict a social conservatism. What would you predict in terms of the church at a time like this? What would you predict when people are uncertain about themselves? I think of that charming story, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, from C.S. Lewis. You remember the island of the monopods? Where those invisible little creatures that hopped along on one leg, on one foot? And they always said to the boss, say it again, boss. Tell it like it is. You got it, boss. Hear, hear, boss. You know, say it again. That in a mythic era, or let's just make it much more personal, a Lee Griffin mythic era, do you have those times of day or those days in a month or a week when you just don't have enough security or self-confidence? You don't want to pick up the phone one more time. You want to talk to one more person. You don't want to enter one more unknown situation. Or even take what looks like a very tiny risk, but you just want to be left alone or not risk anymore, do you? Can you identify with spaces? Maybe it's only minutes or hours or times a day. But when you get a place like that, when you're in a place where, when I'm in a place where Lee Griffin is uncertain of himself and really doesn't want to pick up the phone call for one more call, it doesn't matter whether it's a good call or a bad call, he just didn't want to risk one more call. What kind of people do you think I want to be surrounded with? People that are different from me or people who are the same as I?
People sure.
I want people to say, yeah, right on, Lee. You say it again. You got it. Right. You speak truth. Say it again, Lee. Right. That's sure. That's the kind of people when I'm uncertain about myself. And so when we get, what would you expect then in the people who's lost and fumbling and trying to redefine themselves, what kind of a religious outlook, what kind of churches, what kind of movement of religious response would you think would be growing most rapidly in a mythic era?
Churches that tell people what to believe.
Absolutely. Churches that have 15 laws or 9 credos or 4 ways. Absolutely. Predictability. They're the people who are not having very much budgetary problem. What kind of problems, what kind of churches do you think would be least popular at a time when people are uncertain?
Ones that say things that we don't want to hear.
All right, the ones that say things that we don't want to hear, or the ones that talk about paradox, that talk about being sinner saints, mm-hmm. That talk about keeping things in balance. Those people who are non-definitive, who are non-clear, like Lutherans, who say, yes, you say this, but then you got to hope everyone say that. And yes, we are, but we are not yet. Yeah, we're the becomers. What do you mean you're the becomers? Yeah? And that sort of stuff. And so we go on then with our stats. I don't know how you are in the other Lutheran, but I know the ALC has been losing approximately 25,000 people a year. There are a few pockets that are growing. Our Sunday school stats are down, which is David Preuss's greatest worry, as he sees a drop in there. But what I'm suggesting to you, I guess, is I'll cut it off here. We could go on for a long time, but there are lots of symptomatics that we could talk about. But these are symptoms of what we find where there's more fear, less identity, more anxiety, less sense of surety, less space for grace. Henry Nouwen puts it this way. He said, we're a culture of greed and anger. Greed and anger. That a people who have been promised so very, very much by the media, who have been promised so very, very much, they just get it together. Or by the TV churches, who have said, get Jesus and get happy. Where there has been, where there has been very much promise. He said, the flip side of our quest for intimacy and a high expectation of fulfillment, high promise, when that's not met, the flip side is rage. That we're a culture that is angry. We're a culture that has our reserves for cope reduced. So in my work, in working with congregations and pastors, I'm dealing with 5 times more conflict now than I was 3 years ago. Church-pastor conflict. Intra-parsonage conflict. All forms of conflict. Because people have less space for cope, less space for grace. That we're a beleaguered people. And it's very easy for us to lose our temper, to become polarized, to become less than gracious, to disallow space for the different. So, we're moving within 5 minutes, but let's take a couple minutes at least to clarify. Let me jump ahead to tomorrow. As those of you have noticed on the board, tomorrow it's how then shall we live. So don't give up over the night, folks. But I do want to say, if indeed you believe what we said yesterday, that we are the peculiar people on the face of the earth who, because our hope rests in the promise of a sure God, are invited and admonished to tell it like it is, not the way we'd like to see it, not the way we'd like to have it, but the way it is. Because if we don't, who's going to? If we cannot be the watch people on the towers, then those whose hope rests in data, those whose hope rests in what they see, thus put on the pink glasses and tilt the lenses so they see it looking better and more hopeful. But we're people who have our hope, as John said last night, not resting in optimism or pessimism, but in the promises of God. And so it is only there. It isn't that I speak with you in this way to beleaguer you or to oppress you. If I did not speak from a place of hope, I would not speak at all. Because surely when hope fades, the people indeed does perish. And I would be sorrowful indeed if anything I have said is disillusioning to you. On the other hand, I guess I can't think of any other place but a group of Christians where we can talk about it without being down in the mouth over it. Anyone else have any clarifying questions? Keep a moment. The bell will ring here in 5 minutes or so, but we're okay on time. Any clarifying questions? Have I confused you with what I've said? Not do you agree with me, but what have I said that's confused you, or have I lost you someplace in this?
When you're talking about the Enomian era.
The Enomian era, right.
Without names, that we're
That's it, without name. Yeah, normless is what it really means.
Is that also fit into the people in the identity crisis? Because that's really when came after.
Sure, that's when this stuff started. In the Anomian era, all this stuff had its roots as things were all tossed up for grabs and anything went. And the key was self-actualize, self-fulfill, find yourself.
And
you know, exact your own
meaning. We realize we haven't found ourselves, so we're searching in a different way now.
Yeah. Now the searching has become really more vigorous in that really, we didn't talk about this, that some of the good things that have happened in the ecumenical movement are still going. Let me say that solidly. There is also now a countercurrent that's coming back with all the Lutheran Catholic dialogues and the Lutheran Anglican dialogues and the Methodist Lutheran dialogues and all that sort of stuff. And whereas back in the early 70s, we were saying, gee, we've really got most of our stuff the same, and Jesus Christ is the same, and the other stuff we can tend to. Now there's a counter movement that comes always in a mythic era that says, yeah, but remember, you can't trust those Roman Catholics too far. They're really pretty high on Mary. And the Methodists saying about the Lutherans, those Lutherans are status quo people. You'd never know really that Jesus came once, let alone that he was coming again. But surely nothing very radical happens in their lives. They talk a good game, but you can't get too close to them because they're do-nothings. And the Lutherans say about the Methodists, well, remember, they've got a doctrine of perfection, and they're really pie-in-the-sky people and laying trips on people to all be perfected now after the third pylon instead of waiting for the fourth. So be a little cheery about that. Wesley was kind of an emotionalist. All those counter words now are words that you're going to be hearing. The murmurings are going to be counter murmurings. The racial movement, which had gained much in the 60s and early 70s, now there's a return to separation, kind of a quiescent difference, that much of the energy that went into that has dissipated. In our own church, the movements and the concerns about social justice have quieted. It's not the in thing with the church now. Remember, everything I say is only partly true, but watching the church from inside, we are very faddistic, and we've moved back in this other direction, so we've got waves splashing from all directions on us now. But this is another wave that's been added in our insecurity. Marshall McLuhan says this, we're a people who are in deep need of retribalization. I mentioned that yesterday. He said that means that we're a people who have a deep need for finding a group of people with whom we feel secure. We're a people who are tossed and disheveled and we need to be led beside still waters. We're a people who are beleaguered and assaulted, and we need to be comforted and spoken to a word of grace. And at the same time, amidst all of that, going back to Becker's indictment of us, he said, all of us have our immortality schemas. And the interesting thing about the peoples of the world is that they've been ready to crucify everybody else to prove that their immortality schema, and he'd say ours is Jesus Christ, that their God is God, that their immortality scheme is the immortality scheme. So it's a great time then for us to be mindful as the people of God of leaving space for grace for ourselves, within our families, within our congregations, of counting to 11 or 12 instead of just to 9 or 10, of realizing that we're beleaguered and we're assaulted, that it's a time when, as I move on into tomorrow, when we need to rediscover some rootages and some PowerPoints, some foundational places that will allow us to have that space for grace. Let's stand and have a moment of closing prayer here before we see you.
Just a moment.
You're good. Hands, can we all get together?
Too much work.
Yes. Lord Jesus Christ, we who literally are in a pocket, in an island, a citadel of peace, reflection, who have space for meditation, an opportunity to listen outside the maelstrom to your still small voice. Once again this afternoon, we come before you as your gathered people. Let the linking of our hands symbolize the linking of our hearts in you. That it is not we who have created community, but it is you who have ordained it. Your loving sacrifice on the cross, that you have bought it for us. That you have linked us to yourself and to one another. Grant that as we go forth and move around meals and events and Holden Village, just walking up and down the road, that we might understand deeply and persuasively that not one of us has an ounce of self-esteem or self-confidence to spare. And that a tender word and a listening ear, but a gracious smile, may be the difference in whether we are able to see clearly your hope or not. Grant us that, Lord. For the sake of your love, I ask it.